You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education podcast. I'm Sarah Custer, and today our Chief Knowledge Officer, Phil Beatty, is joining me, along with our Rankings Editor, Ellie Bothwell. Hello.
Hi.
Hi there.
So this is a big time of year for Times Higher Education. It's the moment when months of work, liaising with universities, gathering their data, crunching the numbers, and calculating the results culminate to the release of our flagship rankings, the 2019 World University Rankings. Ellie and Phil, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of the work that does go on behind the year of preparation to the massive release of data.
Yeah, so it is a phenomenal piece of work, actually. We have a very large team of data scientists working on this for several months. We conduct a reputation survey, so at the beginning of the year, January, February, March, we're surveying 10,000 academics across the world. A similar period of time, we're opening up our data portal, so well over 1,500 universities from across the world provide us with lots of detailed information. I think the ranking that we're publishing today has around 230,000 individual data points from the universities themselves, you know, demographic information, financial information, student numbers, staff numbers, international students, international faculty, loads of information from the universities, surveys, masses of number crunching with Elsevier. We're looking at 14.1 million research publications, and they are 67.9 million citations to those publications that are analysed. It's all thrown together and it's then all audited by PricewaterhouseCoopers. So we have a process where they replicate all of our calculations, they build their own code, they replicate the ranking and sign it all off. So it's many months in process with huge help from the universities themselves and a team of about 15 data scientists, data specialists putting it together. So it's a hugely exciting time of year for us, and we're really delighted to be revealing the results.
I think that's quite interesting that a lot of people maybe don't know that universities are giving us their data. They're logging onto our portal and they're sharing with us all of their data points.
Yeah, and we see it as a shared process. We genuinely believe that we're providing information that is of value to the university sector, that really helps the world understand changes in the global higher education sector. And it's a voluntary process. Universities choose to share the information. We ask for really basic sort of demographic stuff, really, and then we add a whole bunch of insights and extra on top, and the universities right through from Oxford and Harvard to the 1,250th ranked institution, they're all want to be part of this process, and it's a really genuinely great thing that there's this process and culture of sharing, that universities want to be benchmarked globally, they want to compare themselves globally, they want to have that access to the data that helps them understand their position in the world. So I think it's a really positive exercise, despite the controversies around rankings.
Hmm. And Ellie, maybe you could tell us, why are we calling them the 2019 World University Rankings if we're releasing them in 2018?
Yeah, so the start of our ranking cycle is, you know, from when we launched this ranking, but it kind of finishes in, you know, August or early September 2019. So actually, you know, this ranking isn't sort of a one sort of release date and then it's over, it sort of lasts for the whole year, and then we'll have various sort of other tables that we'll publish over the next 12 months as well, looking at specific regions or specific types of universities, like young institutions. So yeah, that's why we call it 2019.
Okay, thanks for clearing that up. We'll go into the official results for this year's rankings in a little bit, but I'm wondering, Ellie, if you could talk about some of the trends that you've observed in this year's data.
Yeah, so one of the big trends is around the sort of continued rise of Asia, and in particular China. And so one of the sort of exciting pieces of news is that a Chinese university is top in Asia for the first time sort of under the current methodology of the rankings. So that's Tsinghua University, has now overtaken the National University of Singapore, and it's also overtaken another Chinese university, Peking. Mm. So it's now 22nd, up from 30th. And I mean, it's not sort of necessarily a huge surprise in the sense that Tsinghua is ranked above Peking in our reputation rankings sort of every year, and it also overtook Peking in our Asia rankings earlier this year. But it's certainly interesting that, you know, it's now really high up in the world, and it really sort of improved in areas such as teaching environment, institutional income. So that's, you know, pretty exciting. And in general, in China, you know, several of universities have risen. Southern University of Science and Technology is a sort of new entry in the list, in the 301 to 350 band. And that's very impressive given that the university only opened 7 years ago, and it sort of opened with the aim of basically quickly establishing itself as a world-class university, and it seems to sort of been very successful in that endeavour.
Hmm. Would you say that the rise of the Chinese institutions really comes down to the amount of money that they're able to invest?
I mean, I think funding is definitely a big factor. You know, there's no doubt that you need sort of huge, you know, you need large amounts of money to sort of attract talent and produce research. I mean, in terms of the rise of China, a lot of it is down to their citation impact. They're sort of really improving in terms of research influence, and part of that might be down to sort of collaborating more with universities in other countries. And then their reputation as well is just improving, which, I mean, that reputation is a lagging indicator. So, you know, we've known, I guess, for a while that Chinese universities are on the up, and then it's, you know, becomes reflected in our survey sort of eventually.
I think it's probably worth adding as well that China's been sort of pushing their sort of excellence initiative idea for 3 decades now. They really were the first to go for, we want a group of universities to be globally competitive. And there's been, you know, literally billions of US dollar equivalents invested. But it's things like some of the policies around the sea turtles, so really making a concerted effort to bring back Chinese diaspora who've perhaps pursued their careers in the US or Europe. They've been encouraged to come back, given what they need to build successful research teams and laboratories in China. So it's a long, long process, but it's almost a cliche now, isn't it? The China rising, but we see it. And what's interesting for me is that it's not just those Beijing superstars. There's now the likes of Zhejiang making big steps forward. Some of the Shanghai universities doing quite well. Other regional institutions. SusTech, obviously, in Shenzhen, where we had one of our summits a few years ago. It's more of a diverse group of institutions all starting to show up in the rankings from China. It's really exciting.
Do you think it's the case of a rising tide raises all boats, that as China improves, so do other universities in Asia? Or is China really the standout performer in the region?
If I may jump in, Elliot, I mean, clearly we've seen a very good year for Hong Kong again. And I think Hong Kong is in this very interesting position where they're the sort of best of both worlds. They've got strong ties and cultural links with the West, but they're increasingly able to capitalise on the money and resource that's being ploughed into mainland China. So there's some really interesting opportunities for Hong Kong. Also real challenges to try and keep their uniqueness as they move to be more integrated with the mainland. But at the moment, Hong Kong looks pretty good. But I also think, yeah, as the whole centre of gravity moves to East Asia a bit more, you know, we've got National University of Singapore still doing outstandingly well in 23rd. You've got some really good Korean results, South Korean results, or at least some solid ones. So I do think there's a sense of a more dynamic and thriving East Asian community, which is it's good for talent. It's good for, you know, the geographical critical mass in terms of people and skills. So I think it's potentially good for the whole of Asia, really.
Hmm. So we've talked about Asia. Are there any institutions in other parts of the world that we haven't necessarily seen strong performance from historically on rankings, Phil?
Yeah, there's actually a very good story for Africa. University of Cape Town in South Africa is Africa's number one. It's risen substantially up the ranking. But actually, because we've been able to extend our reach, and we've ranked more universities than ever before. We have more than 1,250 ranked universities. We've been able to include far more institutions overall, but actually Africa's representation has really grown dramatically. I think there's 12 new African universities in the list, and I think more than 40 overall. So it's been very positive to be more inclusive and to show a wider range of good performance. Of course, African universities are behind in terms of the resources available, and you know, they've got some real challenges, but there's some really positive signs there as well.
So are you optimistic that that's a number that you expect to just grow as time goes on, the number of African universities on our list?
Yeah, there's a sense of increased awareness of global comparisons. There's a sense that, you know, for Africa to, you know, realize its potential, it needs to have competitive institutions, it needs to have universities that compete. So, of course, there is this tension where, certainly in sub-Saharan and Africa, there's huge issues of around poverty and around providing basic education to people. There's also an acknowledgement that you can't forget about the top end. You want strong, globally competitive universities to help counter brain drain. You want universities to, you know, be able to compete at the highest levels to strengthen the nation and to drive the economy. So it's about trying to balance. It's a little bit like what we've seen in China, that you had a situation where you had to educate vastly larger numbers of young people, which stretches things dramatically, but at the same time you have to protect quality so it's perhaps more stratification, but much more engagement internationally from top African universities, and much more competitive and much more strategically exciting, in the sense that they're doing some fantastic work in areas that matter to the whole world. And actually the partnerships between the Global South and the Global North are strengthening as well. So we're seeing some really interesting dynamics around those universities not just being about losing talent to the Global North, but actually retaining and circulating talent.
And also maybe forging their own paths after they've seen how universities in the West have been doing it for the past century. They're able to take the best of that and mold it to what works for them.
Yeah, and I think there's a, you know, there's a really nice piece from the president of Cape Town in the ranking supplement about how much work they've been doing to diversify their intake, not just of students but also of academics, particularly improving the representation of Black South Africans. And really they're saying it's actually improving their institution ON, because there's new and different perspectives on how the curriculum should be taught, there's new and different perspectives on world problems, and it's a really healthy, really exciting, positive change for Cape Town, one of the top institutions in the region.
Great. Should we go into our top 10? Ellie, who starts off the top 10 for us this year?
So the University of Chicago is at 10th, down one place from 9th. And Chicago is a leading private university in the US. It's sort of particularly known for strength in its professional schools, so kind of business, law and medicine, sort of particularly well known for. And although it does move one place down, it's sort of improved quite a lot in terms of its teaching performance this year.
So move down one place, but improved teaching performance for the University of Chicago at number 10. Phil, who have we got at number 9?
Number 9, it's Imperial College in London. That's slipped down one place. But actually, Imperial is an outstanding institution. Its strongest performance is citations, the impact of its research. I think people should be aware it's an incredibly powerful science, engineering, business and medicine-based university. The thing that really struck me actually about its data is it's extraordinarily international. It has very high scores for international outlook. And I really loved this line that its president, Alice Gast, gave at one of our summits in the past. Actually, she talked about this notion in botany of hybrid vigor. If you bring different plant species together, you get stronger plants. And she said that's what Imperial is all about. It's about multicultural, diverse international research teams tackling problems differently, bringing different perspectives onto the problems and strengthening the research base. So very outstanding in science and technology, but with a really, really strong international vision. It's a great institution.
Okay, ecosystem of Imperial College London. Ellie, who have we got up next in number 8?
At number 8, it is Yale University, which is a sort of new entry in the top 10 this year. It's moved up 4 places from 12th, and that's the largest movement in the top 20 of the table. You know, Yale is a very prestigious Ivy League university in Connecticut. Sort of particularly well regarded in the arts and social sciences, but you know, pretty broad strength. It makes the top 10 for the first time since 2015 this year, partly because it improves in quite a few of the financial indicators, so institutional income, research income and industry income, but also its kind of research productivity has really improved this year, and also international staff, an area where the US isn't always sort of as international as some of its European peers, but, you know, Yale sort of really improved on that measure.
Okay, interesting. So Yale University up 4 places to 8. What about number 7, Phil? Who have we got?
7, we have Princeton from the US, of course. It's stable in that position. It's had that position for quite some time now. Obviously, a very strong, old liberal arts university in America. I think it's the 4th oldest, in the we could rank on age, it's 1746. One of the things I really like about Princeton is they've got this motto, which I think they took from one of their, I think Woodrow Wilson was one of their presidents back in the day, who became the president of America, of course. But they've pushed this line in the service of humanity. So they put a massive emphasis on service. And of course, all universities serve humanity in wonderful ways. But I think they do it particularly well in Princeton, as in the fact it's a sort of at the forefront of their thinking. So, you know, students are encouraged to think very hard about what they contribute to the world when they graduate. There's a lot of volunteering and all these extra, you know, focus on what they can do to serve mankind. And there's also quite a nice point there that I think a lot of people put the perception of an elite Ivy League liberal arts university in the US would be quite exclusive. But they have a fairly strong representation of students eligible for low-income grants. 22% of their student body is eligible for these federal grants in the US. So it's, you know, quite inclusive as well, or moderately inclusive in the scheme of these things.
And also quite exceptional to have such a highly ranked institution that's so focused on the humanities and arts in our top 10. They do stand out from the pack quite a bit, looking at the rest of the institutions on our list. Ellie, who have we got at number 6?
At number 6, it's Harvard. So probably the sort of biggest name brand university in the world. I mean, it's sort of, yeah, no surprise, I guess, necessarily that it's in the top 10. Maybe a surprise for some that it's kind of as low as 6th. You know, formerly sort of number 1 in the rankings a few years ago. I mean, Harvard, you know, has expertise sort of across the board. It's a real kind of broad range institution, you know, from the arts to the social sciences to kind of hard sciences. It's the top US university in the table for research environment. So that's things like research productivity and income, and also research reputation. And Harvard is also a university that's really been sort of trying to increase its diversity in recent years. So that when we actually have a new president this year, but their former leader, Drew Faust, wrote for us last year, a couple of years ago, about their sort of real drive to just improve diversity in terms of sort of more low-income students, you know, students from diverse racial backgrounds.
So that's Harvard University in 6th place. So we're now moving on to the top 5. Phil, who have we got starting off the top 5?
So 5th is Caltech, California Institute of Technology. Caltech was actually our number 1 for several years. I spent quite a lot of time visiting Caltech as a journalist, I should stress, not as a student. They wouldn't let me in. But it's just a remarkable institution. It's in Pasadena, you know, not too far from Hollywood. It's probably quite well known for the Big Bang Theory. It's the university, this fictional comedy set around. But actually, it's just an amazing place. It's tiny. It has only around 1,000 undergraduates, so they have this phenomenally intense faculty-student ratio. So students get really strong access to the top professors. So all these Nobel Prize winners, you can actually mix with them and mingle with them on campus. So the intimacy of the environment is amazing for undergraduates. And I love this. All US schools have got honor codes, but Caltech has this wonderfully trust-driven honor code where students often will sit exams at home without any supervision. They're trusted to take the allotted 3 hours to complete their papers, but there's a massive degree of trust. Students often get keys to access extremely high-tech, expensive laboratories.
Wow.
Students are encouraged to actually carry out research projects with the leading professors. It's just a really great environment. So they're 5th. They have been slipping a little bit, but they're still obviously an outstanding institution across the board.
Is it often the case, if some institution slips that was previously at the top of our list, is it often the case that maybe their performance hasn't changed, but just the performance of their peers on the list has improved?
Yeah, I think an analogy I've used is a bit like an Olympic 100-meter sprint, that tiny margin. They're all outstanding institutions, finely honed, incredibly fit and healthy institutions across the board, and very, very small margins can make the difference. So it may be down to, you know, really, really small changes, like a particular super research paper falling off our period, or someone's grants and everyone's grants are growing, but actually growing at a faster rate. So absolutely, I think it certainly doesn't imply decline if you've slipped in that our top echelon. Everyone's really tightly packed in that space anyway.
Okay, continuing on that tight space, Ellie, number four, who have we got?
We've got MIT, so that's the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. That's up one place this year. And MIT is sort of known to be a very kind of innovative technology engineering university. You know, I mean, I think one of the sort of criticisms of a lot of universities is potentially the sort of levels of bureaucracy, the fact that they move at quite a slow pace in comparison to industry, that, you know, there are kind of lots of processes to work through. But actually, MIT is really known for being a very bottom-up university. And a bit like Phil was saying about Caltech, it gives a lot of freedom to its researchers. It's sort of, and I've spoken to people from MIT before, it very much seems that it's the kind of researchers themselves that kind of lead the agenda and decide the changes they want. There isn't really a sort of, kind of strategy from the president, especially kind of controlling what they do. MIT is, you know, another outstanding university, and it's also top in the US for international outlook, which, as I mentioned, you know, isn't an area that the US as a whole, you know, does well on compared to some of its European peers, but MIT sort of leads the US on that.
MIT at number four. Phil, who have we got in third spot?
So in third place, it's Stanford University, another US institution. Top 10 is dominated by the US. What can you say about Stanford? It's world-renowned. It's very much smack bang in the heart of Silicon Valley, in San Francisco, or certainly in the Bay Area. Phenomenally entrepreneurial, very closely aligned with the tech developments and the ecosystem around Silicon Valley. One of the things that always strikes me about Stanford and many of these top US schools is just how wealthy they are. I had a tour of Stanford a few years ago by someone from the education faculty, and they were actually slightly embarrassed by how opulent the campus is. I think they've got a situation where they often, or maybe this is a little bit of a tall story, but their estate is so outstanding that they have to knock down really great, relatively new buildings to make space for the extra super cool new buildings they're building. Wow. They're just ultra wealthy, incredibly entrepreneurial, closely tapped into the high-tech world in Silicon Valley, and, you know, all round good performance. What's striking actually with MIT as well, I think, Ellie, is that they're renowned for their technology and their STEM work, but actually they've really built great arts and humanities and social science provision as well. So they recognize actually that a lot of the more cutting-edge developments these days do need to be sort of more multidisciplinary, that you actually need great humanities scholars in the same room or in the same space as technology scholars to actually get to the next level around where we're going with AI, with you know, machine learning and robotics and the fourth industrial revolution.
Yeah, so they're really kind of tackling that binary between STEM and the humanities and trying to bring them together.
Yeah.
Another reason why they're probably at the forefront. Ellie, top two, who have we got? Second place?
Second place, it's the University of Cambridge. So, it stays in second place for the second year in a row. And Cambridge has actually improved sort of across the board this year. So, you know, better teaching, better research, better citation impact, more stronger links with industry, more international, which I think is quite interesting because, you know, it stayed the same, but it kind of shows that for a lot of universities to kind of remain where they are, they have to really improve. You know, a bit like going back to your point earlier about why some universities fall, you know, you really have to kind of up your game if you want to just kind of stand still in the rankings. I mean, Cambridge is known for, you know, its strengths across the board again, maybe a little bit more well known for its sort of strengths in the science and medicine. And obviously, you know, it's one of the oldest universities in the UK, in the world. you know, it's had sort of centuries of sort of funding and alumni and built up its research and teaching reputation. So, that's why Cambridge is number two.
Great. And who's topping our list this year, Phil? Do the big reveal.
Well, sadly, it's a little bit boring because it's the university that's been in that top spot for now 3 years in a row. It's Oxford University in the UK. I have to say, I was genuinely surprised a few years ago when we had Oxford and Cambridge 1 and 2, because Britain as a whole, I think, is under pressure. There's pressure on funding, pressure on talent. You know, our immigration policies are not particularly conducive to welcoming international talent. So, It's surprising how outstandingly well they do, but of course, you know, Oxford, very similar to Cambridge, it's centuries old. I think it's probably claims to be the oldest university in the English-speaking world. It's, you know, traces its origins back to the, you know, at least 900 years, if not slightly earlier. But actually, funnily enough, people do tend to think that Cambridge is the STEM institution and Oxford's more arts and humanities. And actually, Oxford's, you know, like Cambridge, very strong across the board. Oxford's had the number one medical ranking for since we began that ranking, actually. So it's outstanding in combining both. I mean, one thing that perhaps not necessarily familiar to international listeners is the unique tutorial system at both Oxford and Cambridge. You know, there's a process where undergraduates get a really intense one-on-one experience with tutors, which is very hard to replicate, very expensive to deliver, but something quite unique to Oxbridge. And of course, a collegial system, so a very immersive undergraduate experience. And again, you know, a situation where undergraduates do get relatively close proximity to real superstars of research, and they're, you know, recipients of vast sums of research funding to carry out research across the board at the cutting edge.
And another thing that makes those two institutions stand out specifically in the UK is the fact that they've both received massive tranches of private investment funding in the past year, which is more along the lines of what funding models would look like in the United States. So surely that's contributing to them being on the top again this year.
Yeah, I think fundraising is a really increasingly important part for all universities across the world. Obviously, people look at the US as the leaders in the professionalization of fundraising, you know, going out, rattling your tin and asking for philanthropic donations. Britain's really spent the last decade trying to work out how to do it better, how to instill a culture of giving. But obviously, I think if you have the clout of Oxford and Cambridge, it's a big machine and a big brand that helps attract philanthropy. But of course, they've put real investment into professionalizing the whole process of raising funding, right through from, you know, working with your alumni on relatively potentially small but high volume donations, right through to wooing the huge philanthropists of this world and securing some big bucks.
Great. Well, in case you weren't paying attention, I'll run through this year's top 10 one more time. In 10th place, we've got the University of Chicago, 9th, Imperial College London, 8th, Yale University, 7th, Princeton University, 6th, Harvard University, 5, it's Caltech, California Institute of Technology, 4, MIT, 3, Stanford University, 2, the University of Cambridge, and coming at number 1 again this year is University of Oxford. All of our data is on our website, timeshighereducation.com, and you can go and explore the data to your heart's content. You can see how institutions compare based on things like ratio of female to male students, the number of students per staff, the number of international students on campus. So please do feel free to go and check out all of the latest data in the 2019 World University Rankings. Thanks very much for joining me today, Phil and Ellie.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Sarah Custer, and we'll see you next time.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.